Insider podcast and YouTube blog covering the German startup scene with news, interviews, and live events.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Joe from StartupRate.io, your startup podcast and YouTube blog from Germany. If you're new to us or listen of you this podcast the first time, go down here and hit the like and subscribe button wherever you watching this or listening to this. Today I welcome another podcaster as a part of Media Exchange, Frank from Virginia. Hey, how you doing?
Great, Joe. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure having you because I also appeared on your podcast, and usually we do that to give each other exposure to the other podcast audience. But you're also a very interesting startup-like guy. That's why I like to have you on my podcast, because in the past you've also been working in startup, in technology, even as a CEO, right?
That's right. That's right. I created a startup back in the late 1990s during the dot-com internet explosion. And it was called Document Planet. I had a long history in the printing industry. And I'd also been a very early adopter of online technology. I actually accepted print jobs online before the internet existed. So I thought it was when the internet boom came along, I thought it was a great opportunity to leverage my experience and my brand in the industry, my personal brand in the industry, to launch a printing.com. It was called, as I say, Document Planet.
And it was headquartered in Virginia?
Alexandria, Virginia, not far from where I'm sitting right now.
I see, I see. Can you share a little bit with us your experience? Because at this time, I do believe it was, you're still talking about a burn rate at a startup, the amount of cash you're losing like every month in a startup. At this point in time, you said it was actually, you needed a burn rate in order to show that you needed the money in the first place, right?
That's right. Things were different then. This was before the lean startup was written. And believe it or not, the paradigm at that time was the exact opposite. The idea was to spend as much money as possible, as quickly as possible, in an effort to show that you needed more money. The whole thing was kind of crazy. Because it's so far in the past now, a lot of people may not remember that there was a lot of discussion about what was called the new economy, that traditional rules of economics had been suspended, no longer applied. You don't have to make a profit. You just have to grow, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, all those things have been proven incorrect, and hence things like the lean startup concept, which I adhere to and believe in 100%, particularly having lived the exact opposite and seeing what a disastrous approach it was. But what I want to share, or would like to share with people who are either currently the founder of a startup or considering founding a startup, is that, you know, there's a pot of gold, or potentially a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. But you need to understand also that this is going to be probably the hardest you'll ever work and the most stress that you will ever go under, at least from a professional standpoint, than in any other point in your career, and certainly any previous point in your career. These investors are funny that they want their money back, and they're not kidding. And they're very serious and very serious business people, and you need to be able to perform. And as human beings, we can't always do what we had hoped or what we had promised. It's very stressful, and I have a few ideas on how you can keep that stress to a minimum and maximize the potential for success for yourself and for your startup.
Would you share this with us before we get into the part where you actually list the Document Planet?
Sure. Number one, when I came into this, I had never had, you know, I was about to say I'd never had experience in a startup before, but that's not true. I actually had been involved in a startup that had an amazing run for about 6 months, and then it was acquired by a giant multinational company. And believe it or not, the circumstances of that were such that I had to sign a non-disclose that this transaction had ever even occurred. So that's about all I can tell you about it. But I would say that my learning experience there was not really that instructive because the circumstances of this startup were so unique. But I would recommend that you find yourself a job in a startup first. Get a feel for the mania and the stress and the hours and the fear and trepidation that goes on about, are we going to get that next tranche of funding? Are we going to be able to get our B round or whatever it is? How are we going to make payroll next cycle if we don't? And so forth, so that you get a real feel for the environment. It's a very different working environment, again, as I say, than any other place you ever worked. After you've done that, if you're lucky, if it was a successful startup, you might have gotten some options. Maybe you got some money out the door. And then you're ready, perhaps, to start your own. Keep in mind that when you do your first startup, it's not going to be your last startup, let's hope. Don't try to hold on to 51% of ownership or maintain control. I mean, you should try and you should keep control as long as you can. But keep in mind that this is your first go-round and the golden rule applies. The people with the gold set the rules. And if they want to bring in a professional management team, or they're going to push you out completely, or they're going to change the business model or what have you, you need to roll with the punches and just look at it as much of a learning experience as you can. Again, if you're fortunate, I don't know exactly the statistics, but I think it's only 1 out of 5 or maybe fewer startups that actually succeed and turn into profitable businesses. If you're one of those 1 out of 5, great. Eventually, you will part ways with that company. And again, if you're lucky, you'll have some money in the bank. When you go to do your next startup, you're going to be a much more experienced person than you had been previously. You'll probably do a better job with execution. You'll be able to attract a better team. You'll already know who to go to ask for investment capital. You'll just understand so many things that right now you don't even know what you don't know. And then eventually what happens, and I think you'll agree with this, Joe, is people who create startups stop creating startups. They end up with enough money in the bank that they invest in other people's startups, and they let those people work 200 hours a week and go through the stress and pulling their hair out and losing their marriage and et cetera. And then they are the person who sets the rules because they're the one with the gold now.
I see. I found a few of your statements pretty interesting, especially 1 in 5 startups succeed. Actually, I've heard more the number like 1 in 10. Nonetheless, even your more favorable statistic means that you have to try at least 5 times, statistically speaking, to be successful once. And it doesn't make sense to invest all your life savings, take on credit as much as you can, just to get this one startup off the ground, because there may or may not be 4 more before you become successful, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. You don't know what's going to happen. And there are a lot of exogenous variables. And by that, I mean acts of God, like COVID and other things that can occur that completely unforeseen and completely out of your control. But even without acts of God, there are market forces and other things, like maybe your business model wasn't such a great idea after all.
That always reminds me of pets.com. For everybody who doesn't know that, it was a .com startup that basically burned a lot of money. And I think they assumed that they'll sell many, many very expensive items to dog owners, like diamond collars and stuff like that, in order to break even. So that wasn't the most sustainable business model, but nonetheless, they got funding. Getting a little bit back to Document Planet, you write in your LinkedIn that you raised more than $3 million in venture capital, and then you listed. Is that the way you went, and how did you approach that?
Thanks. That's a good question. One of the important points about Document Planet was the timing. We started into it. We first start to get traction in the investment community late in the dot-com boom. And by the time we really did start to attract money, the dot-com boom was becoming the dot-com implosion. And it became increasingly difficult to raise capital, no matter whether you had the best business model in the world. So we became desperate. And as a result, my advisors and my investors insisted that we go forward with what's called a reverse merger with a public shell company. And this is similar to a SPAC. In fact, there's a an episode I have on my podcast, Radio Free Enterprise. If you just search for the word SPAC, you'll find it, where the differences between a reverse merger and a SPAC are defined. But in any event, we decided to do this reverse merger so that we could become a publicly traded company, which meant that the trading in our shares became liquid. There was a liquid market for people to invest and people to get out. And, you know, it was a Hail Mary, as we would call it, Hail Mary pass, and it did not work out. But I did learn, you know, that the education I got from that was worth a few million dollars. I went from never having any involvement with a publicly traded company to becoming not only the CEO, but the chairman of the board of a publicly traded company. Now, we were a very small company, but we had the same reporting requirements as any other publicly traded company, and at least, you know, within certain parameters. I had to, you know, run board meetings. I had a board of directors that were a bunch of hard-bitten money people, and it just... You talk about an education. I certainly received one. And it also gave me a great perspective on the difference between a privately held company and a publicly held company. And one of those things, and one of the reasons why becoming a publicly traded company actually impacts and impedes the execution of your business model, is all the pressure from the public markets and from investors for short-term results. And in a lot of cases, a public company and a startup company are almost like Alice through the looking glass. It's almost as if the rules of actual business are suspended. You know, we don't care whether you're actually making a profit. We don't care about this. Many things that would be important if you were private. You have other objectives that you need to serve.
Like meeting revenue targets?
Yes. Well, of course, that's important. That's always important. But then, you know, revenue's great, but what about profits? I had a meeting with a fund manager in Philadelphia, and this was, again, during the dot-com boom, and everybody had money and everybody's investing. This guy had no experience being a fund manager, and I came to him asking for $5 million and, you know, for this next round of what we were going to do and how we're going to expand and how we're going to increase revenues. And he looked at me and he said, "You know, I have $125,000 in my fund that my responsibility is to invest. And if I did it at $5 million a shot, I'd have to manage 25 deals. And I don't want to do that. So you're asking for $5 million. How about if I give you $15 million? And I thought, well, you know, that's great. But then he went on to say, "If I give you $15 million today, can you roll this idea out nationwide in the next 180 days? And I said, "Certainly not." And he goes, "Well, there's the door." So that's the kind of, you know, as I say, Alice through the looking glass thing that you need to look out for. And one of the important points there is for founders of startups, you want to look for the right investors, not just any investors. You need to look for people who can bring value beyond just their money in terms of their Rolodex connections, their experience in your industry, their ability to accelerate execution, their ability to shorten sales cycles. There's so many things that a strategic investment can do for you, smart money, beyond dumb money, which is just somebody who can write a check.
So basically, your recommendation would be, we actually had an American guest here who started a startup company in Berlin, mental high five to Luca, and he said almost the same, like don't marry the sexiest people, but the ones who bring most to the table. I think that goes down here along your alley.
That's right. That's great. Yeah, that's exactly right. Another thing I found was there is no direct correlation between how much money an investor has and how high their IQ is. I met a lot of people. I remember one time I was demonstrating our online order system to somebody using WebEx. This is way back when. And this guy was so fascinated with WebEx that he couldn't get past that. He thought that's what I was demonstrating. And in fact, he said, well, no, I don't know what you're selling, but I want to invest in this company. And so I'm like, okay, great.
Sorry, it took me a while to shift back to be, there was just so funny. One more point I want to talk about before we go on. I know the American mindset is a little bit different from the German one, because here IPO is really a big thing, and most startups who do an IPO do it in the 10 to 100 million range. Order One is actually looking at more than 1.5 billion euros at the time we're recording this, because you listen to our recording live from tape, of course. And at the time, I assume your IPO was a little bit smaller. What did actually drive you to do that? Was it getting access to public markets? Was it just the next logical step? Did your investors pressure you to do it, or did you just want to try it?
Well, keep in mind, a reverse merger is not an initial public offering. And again, if you go to Radio Free Enterprise and look up IPO, you'll find this episode where the guy actually, who was my partner in Document Planet, explains all the differences. But in any event, no, we did it totally out of desperation and in order to persuade other private investors to invest. It wasn't really to go to the public market and try to get the public to invest. It was to persuade new investors that their money would not just be going down a hole, that it would be going into a company where, if they chose to, they could take their money back out again through the public markets.
Did you and your partner actually sell a lot of your holdings during this time?
Mm-hmm. And this is another thing, as I mentioned earlier, for your first startup. You know, they call it getting crammed down or diluted. And it, this is something you need to be prepared for. It's really important that you go into this understanding in your own mind, why am I doing this? Am I doing this to become rich? Am I doing this because I have such a passion for the business? What? There has to be a compelling why. And, you know, it's all arithmetic. So I started out with, I think, like 3 million shares. You know, but if a share is worth nothing, then it's not worth anything. By the time it was all done, I had 770,000 shares. And again, if it's worth nothing, it was worth nothing. But it did trouble me at how I was being diluted and how other people were coming in. But I had got a funny perspective on this, Joe. I think you'll like this. When I interviewed my partner here recently about this, you know, 20 years later, he says his perspective on dilution is, who's really getting diluted? The investor is handing you $100,000 and you're handing him a stock certificate. So who's really experiencing dilution at that point? And I thought that was important. So this is why I encourage startup founders to realize this is not going to be your last startup. Maybe not, hopefully not. So go with the punches, do what you feel is the right thing to do at the time. Try to minimize your concerns about your own wealth or well-being in it. I mean, but the most important thing is your personal well-being. And if you, for example, like me, are absolutely miserable working with the investors and trying to struggle, it just wasn't worth it, Joe. And I ended up with nothing. I ended up, I personally guaranteed the lease on our offices, ended up having to go to court and settle that. I guaranteed the lease on our computer equipment if we'd gone with the lean startup method, we never would have had any of that. And I ended up, I remember sitting in a courtroom and coming with a settlement and making those payments. It was a miserable situation. And let me give you just one story that I think can emphasize how important it is to be true to yourself and not get in bed with investors that are going to make you miserable. 9/11, September 11th, the attacks of September 11th occurred while I was the CEO of Document Planet. And, you know, Alexandria, Virginia is quite nearby to Washington, D.C. We were not far from the Pentagon. A lot of people who live around here, their parents or they work for the Defense Department. It was a terrible, terrible day here in this area. At about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I let everybody at my office go home and be with their families. The next day, I got a phone call from one of my investors who said, "Hey, I called your office at 3 o'clock in the afternoon yesterday and nobody answered the phone. What kind of an organization are you running over there?" And I thought, what am I doing? Why am I dealing with a person like this? And but once you take their money, you got to take that call.
I see. Very, very interesting perspective. Plus, we are talking here for another topic because a lot of my audience is not from the US. Approximately a third of my listeners and viewers are from the US and Canada. Even for the people in Canada, John Oliver calls so nicely North Dakota. It may be of interest when you are looking to enter the US market. Is it worth a look around the area, DC, Alexandria? Can you talk a little bit about what is going on there in terms of tech companies, startup companies in general?
Sure. This area is where America Online originally started. And many, many moons ago, I actually went to their first headquarters in Tysons Corner, Virginia. Did not meet Steve Case, but he came into the room when I was meeting with some of the people there. And they then moved to another nearby location in Northern Virginia. And as a result, because, I don't know if you recall, but at one time, AOL was the biggest internet provider in the world by far. And AOL in some ways was the internet. That obviously is long in the past now. But as a result, they attracted a lot of other similar companies in this area of Northern Virginia. They also brought with them a lot of internet infrastructure. I remember during our interview previously, you told me that Frankfurt has the world's largest internet knot. And I'm not sure how large the one is that's in Ashburn, Virginia, but it's pretty big and they're constantly building new data centers. So as a result, there are a lot of data centers here in Ashburn, Virginia, and they're building more all the time. Since you said there's such a large knot there in Frankfurt, you've probably seen a lot of these big boxes that are, huge, million square feet, and only 10 people work inside. So that continues to grow here. So telecom is a big investment area here. Cybersecurity, anything that lays on top of all those servers and all those wires is big. Government contracting is a huge area of investment here in the DC area. If you go to, again, my podcast and search for the word London, you'll find an interview I did with an angel investor who only invests in cybersecurity, military, and government startups. So as with anywhere else in the world, you'll find startups, you'll find a printing startup, you'll find all kinds of different startups, but primarily government contracting, cybersecurity, and technology.
That's very interesting. And of course, thinking about cybersecurity, the headquarters of the NSA as well as the CIA are not too far away from you. So there's like a big demand, right?
Yes. And the CIA headquarters is an interesting place. I in a totally different job. In fact, a job I had to take with a home improvement company after Document Planet exploded. I ended up on the campus of the CIA out in Langley, Virginia. On a construction job I was involved with.
Can you actually talk about this? Are you permitted to say I was there?
Yeah, I was there. Anyway, but yes, yeah, clearly the CIA, the NSA, all of those, there's, in fact, not far from where I am here, there's some kind of a surveillance installation at an Army base that they don't even talk about what goes on over there. But I know that there's a lot of satellite dishes. A couple of them, you can see the top rims of them above the trees. But yeah, there's some serious reconnaissance and surveillance and intelligence activity here in the DC area. And, you know, a kid in high school or somebody who knows how to code, a white hat hacker, you just never know who's going to come up with an idea that somebody in the government is going to glom onto. And the difference with the government as a client is you can go from zero revenues to hundreds of millions of dollars in revenues with the stroke of a check or the stroke of a pen on a contract. That's one of the reasons why government contracting startups are so attractive to investors.
And you could go from writing one offer, one presentation after another for years without money as well.
Yes, you could. I've been there, done that. Made a lot of investor presentations.
Well, Frank, it was such a pleasure having you here. We talked about your experience as a dot-com CEO. We talked about what's going on in Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. And of course, everybody who would like to learn more about you, we'll have the podcast we did together down here in the show notes. I'll look for the podcast with the spec you talked about with your former partner. That will be down here in the show notes. And everybody who would like to learn more, of course, there will be your LinkedIn profile as well as your podcast website where people can reach out to you. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure having you as a guest.
Thank you so much, Joe. The pleasure was all mine.
If you are a professional looking at the European startup scene, Germany is a place you cannot miss. Fortunately for you, there is startuprad.eu, the authority on German startups. This English-only podcast brings you fresh interviews each week. Most likely, you have never heard or read anything on these startups before in English, but you will in the future. Be ahead of the curve and subscribe to startuprad.eu podcast, or check for the startuprad.eu internet radio station. Check your Alexa for the startuprad.eu skill as well.